here on News 101.
Right here on News 101.
What motivated you to become a candidate in the provincial election?
The media portrayal of last week's protest that resulted in polarizing images of black-clad activists taking to the streets.
He was just explaining to us the reason why they wanted to show this film on campus.
The official stance is that we are for the Olympics.
News 101 reporter Brad Pepping was there.
By discriminating against homeless people in Vancouver, there's a disproportionate impact on Aboriginal people as well as people with disabilities.
I was pretty outraged. I mean, it is outrageous.
In-depth coverage from an alternative perspective.
You're listening to News 101, Vancouver's only live, volunteer-produced, student and community newscast, offering you local, national, and international news from an alternative perspective.
What's left of us? Just a big mistake.
Good evening, and thanks for joining us on this Monday evening. On the show, UBC reporters will bring you the latest headlines from the student newspaper. In local news, we bring you coverage on research being conducted on addiction and mental health issues here in Vancouver. In national news, we are bringing you a live interview with a Ryerson University student who helped get the university to pledge to become bottled water free. This is the first Ontario university to make such a pledge. All of this, plus your headlines from Free Speech Radio News and your weekday weather forecast this hour on News 101. And first, we have UBC reporters Kathy Lee and Paul Bucci in studio to bring us the latest headlines from the campus newspaper. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much. And here's what's going on today. The force may be strong in campus politics this year. The Arts Undergraduate Society elections are underway, and the only candidate for VP Finance may be a wizened Jedi. Obi-Wan Kenobi was the only name approved to be on the ballot for VP Finance. Represented by arts student Simon Pulsers, Kenobi was one of many joke candidates running this year with Star Wars connections. Others include Admiral Ackbar and Mace Windu, but he's the only one running unopposed. Elections Administrator Matthew Naylor said that while one other candidate was nominated for the position, they failed to attend the all-candidates meeting, which is grounds for disqualification. Kenobi is best known for mysteriously disappearing into a pile of rags upon being hit with a lightsaber by Anakin Skywalker on the original Death Star. Kenobi is a Jedi High Master and spent most of his latter years hiding on Tatooine, a desert planet resembling the climate of Northern Africa.
In other arts news, the Arts Undergraduate Society is taking a page out of Commerce's book. They're planning a referendum to ask students whether they want their student fees to increase for building upgrades starting next year. AUS President Gil Hull sent out a mass email to arts students which says that the vote will continue until March 19 at 5 p.m. If the referendum passes, arts students' fees will increase. The increase is to fund a new student social and study space in the Buchanan West Courtyard and upgrades to the Meekinson Arts student space that will add club offices, group study rooms, and multimedia meeting rooms. The fee will cease once the AUS has fulfilled its financing obligations. Hull said that the Buchanan A block will be completed in September 2010 and that the courtyard enclosed by the A, B, and C buildings will be completely revamped.
Vancouver-based author Douglas Copeland is one of 12 individuals who are recipients of an honorary degree from UBC. The degrees are given to individuals who have made substantial contributions to society at the provincial, national, or international levels. The rest of this year's recipients include Vanox CEO John Furlong, comedian Rick Mercer, famous band leader Dal Richards, chief technology officer at TELUS Communications Earhead Gidon, and former Dean of Science Maria Clough.
Campus security has broken down the numbers, and the verdict is in. Break-and-enters are down, but thefts are up. It's one of the many conclusions in Campus Security's annual report, compiled by Tony Mann, director of the UBC Campus Security. It assessed the total number of property and personal crimes reported to UBC Security in 2008 and 2009. Mann said that the most significant change was a decrease in break-and-enters from 104 incidents in 2008 to 20 incidents in 2009. While break-and-enters may have decreased, the incidents of property thefts from vehicles are on the rise across campus. Though 13 incidents were reported in 2009, this number is expected to rise dramatically in 2010.
And lastly, administration at UBC has started a blog designed to better communicate with students the thoughts of UBC's top executives. The blog is called The Admin Blog, or as UBC VP students Brian Sullivan calls it, the A-Blog. It currently features posts on UBC's budget and governance. According to the site, the blog will include senior admin observations, reactions, and questions on events, ideas, and issues as they emerge. The blog can be found at blogs.ubc.ca/theadministration. And for Kathy Ann Lee, this is Paul Bucci. Thank you very much.
And thanks both of you for that coverage. We are going to take a quick break, but stay with us for coverage of Ryerson University's pledge to go bottled water free.
Last night, I left the bar. I was thirsty, and I don't drink wine. I was desperate. I needed blood. I turned to the only place I could. The only place that could possibly help me.
Hello, Canadian Blood Services.
Hello. I need some blood. A. Positive or negative, it doesn't matter.
I'm sorry, we're all out of A positive and negative. Would you like some O instead?
No. No, that won't do. Thank you. Good night. Save me. Save yourself. Give blood. Voluntarily.
This message was brought to you courtesy of the Canadian Blood Services and CITR Radio 101.9 FM.
The AIDS Vancouver Helpline is here to help. Open from 9 to 4, Monday to Friday, the helpline answers questions about HIV and safer sex. Call to find medical support in your area without giving your name. Run by volunteers, the helpline is one of many programs from AIDS Vancouver combating the HIV epidemic in the Lower Mainland. While not medical professionals, our volunteers answer your questions confidentially and anonymously. The helpline number is 604-696-4666 or contact us online at www.aidsvancouver.org.
You know, Joe, you start with these riffs in your head.
We're good.
And something you want to say, and you want to spin gold, but the thing is, people don't want your sounds. They only want...
You people, you're the fucking coolest!
Just fucking use you. You know what I'm saying, Joe?
What is that? What is it? One more shot and salute?
Sore Throats, Clapping Hands, hosted by Robert Privet, Monday at midnight on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
And in the end, it's love. And in the end, it's love. And in the end, it's love.
I'm Peter Mansbridge, and you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
And you're listening to News 101 coming from you at the University of British Columbia. Thanks for being with us. We now turn to national news. Andrew McAllister, a Ryerson University student, is on the line to discuss the recent pledge by the university to become a bottled water-free campus. This would make it the first bottled water-free campus in Ontario. Thanks for being with us, Andrew.
Thanks for having me today.
So can you tell us... just briefly, what happened last week and in regards to this pledge?
Yeah, so on March 11th, it was the first bottled water free day in Canada. And our president, Sheldon Levy, as well as the president of both of our unions on campus, student unions, signed a pledge which basically commits to building a bottled water free campus and reestablishing water fountains and fill stations.
And this would make, so obviously this is a pledge. It's not, it doesn't mean that Ryerson is at this point in time bottled water free. What are the steps that the university administration is committing to make it a bottled water free campus? Obviously you said drinking fountains, but what's, you know, like, could you give us a timeline on how long you think it'll take to make it, to implement these actions?
Yeah, so we do, because there is a contract on campus with Coke and with Pepsi in our student center, we do have to look into that and obviously tell Coke and Pepsi that we no longer want to sell bottled water on campus and just the product of bottled water. So apart from that, is looking at reestablishing water fountains. So there's actually a lot of work that's being done right now to do that. And in meetings that we had previously with our administration, they actually had a three-year plan to upgrade water fountains on campus. And that was kind of their timeline of how long it would take to accomplish that. So the pledge actually commits to achieving a bottled water-free campus by 2013, when the water fountains will have been all installed and are ready to go.
Now, here on the UBC campus, it's been difficult for the Alma Mater Society, the student union that represents undergraduate and graduate students here on campus, to see what the contracts with these pop providers say, including Coca-Cola. Has there been difficulty on the Ryerson campus to know what those contracts say and know what the administration has agreed to?
Yeah, we did raise the issue of the contract we have. Our university has actually been losing money from our Coca-Cola contract. The reason for that is each year in the contract, there's an expectation for the institution to sell more and more products. And in fact, we've actually been seeing the opposite trend at Ryerson. So we've been seeing that students are actually buying less and less. Bottled water, to now, is still the number one selling product. But the overall amount of bottles sold is actually going down. So that means we're receiving less funding that's going to groups on campus from Coke, which is part of these contracts as well, and losing a significant amount of money. So the contract itself wasn't really a concern of the university. They recognized that, you know, they were losing money. They're going to have to renegotiate it at some point, and that this was something they wanted to do regardless of what Coke says.
And now there has been significant support from the Ryerson University Student Union and the executive of your student union, that's correct?
Yeah, so both the Ryerson Student Union and the Continuing Education Students Association of Ryerson, those are both of our two student unions on campus. They worked very closely with myself and with other people to plan our events for March 11th. And since they do own the Student Campus Center, at Ryerson, we've been working a little bit faster on making that facility bottled water free. So we've actually eliminated the sale of bottled water in both the cafe and in our campus pub as well. There's a water fountain that's being installed this week, and then for orientation, of course, there won't be any bottled water given out, and it'll all be reusable water bottles and clean canteens that will be available to students.
Now, have some students expressed concern about not being able to, you know, if they're at a sports game or they've got different activities going on, just being able to get a bottle of water that's obviously contained, and they don't have to worry about bringing a container? Are there issues around that and concerns that have been raised from people who would like to still have access, maybe in a limited way, but still regardless have access to bottled water?
Yeah, students have definitely raised concern over that. And one of the points in the pledge is actually at events where bottled water was previously sold or available, to replace that, in fact, with tap water. So to have you know, compostable cups and a fountain nearby, or water jugs, water coolers, something like that, so that that water is still available.
Now, how long have you been working on this issue?
I just started this issue over the summer and started kind of researching just why this was an issue and why campuses were getting involved. And then since then, I've just been getting more involved and making it happen here at Ryerson.
And now, what other clubs and groups on campus and maybe national advocacy groups and environmental groups have been part of this campaign on the Ryerson campus and in a larger context across the country?
So here, here at Ryerson, we have our two student unions that have supported this, and again have passed motions within the organizations to adopt this issue and to make it work through the entire organization. We also have the Green Action Group, which was a group that I founded in residence, and we work on, this is one of the issues we actually raised and that we worked on, bottled water. We also do a few things on composting and recycling. Residence Council as well on campus has been really supportive. Nationally, the actual campaign of Bottled Water Free Day is a joint initiative between the Canadian Federation of Students, Polaris Institute, and the CR Youth Coalition. So those are the three groups that have come together and are working to kind of bring this across the country.
Now, not to throw you on the spot, but why is bottled water problematic, and can you speak to the problems that it poses environmentally?
Absolutely. There's so many problems we're seeing with bottled water. A lot of times people don't see it right away, and I encourage them to do the research and to look at our websites and to really find out what it is. Briefly, we're seeing the industry undermine public's confidence in tap water. Here in Toronto, for example, and this is the same all across the country, our tap water here in Toronto is tested every 4 to 6 hours. Bottled water facilities are inspected every 3 to 6 years. So that's a fact that people don't know. Our landfills are filling up, and the thing about bottled water is that it's a product that we can already get from our tap. So there's absolutely no need to package it and to sell it in the way it's being used here in Canada, at least. So we have our landfills filling up. We have the plastic, and again, it's available from the tap. So there's really no need to have it as a product and to use it as the way we do.
Well, thank you, Andrew. I think we'll leave it at that. Any final comments you would like to leave our listeners with here in Vancouver?
Definitely students from across the country, you know, to get them involved in this campaign. There's so many different things you can do. I mean, the simplest one, of course, is to just, you know, clearly just stop drinking bottled water, to bring a clean canteen, bring something like that to your work or to school, and to encourage other students to do the same.
Well, thank you so much for being with us, and good luck with the ongoing campaign.
Thank you very much.
Okay, take care now. And that was Andrew McAllister, a university student at Ryerson in Toronto, speaking to us about the recent pledge by the university to get rid of bottled water on campus. And we spoke to him live from Toronto. So we're now going to take a quick break and go to some public service announcements, but stay with us. You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
SpongeBob, you're wasting me precious carbon dioxide. I'm pumping it into the atmosphere, boy. Thanks to global warming, the temperature will soon go through the roof, and then we'll have an endless summer.
Why do you want an endless summer, Mr. Krabs?
So I can open me latest money-making venture, the Krusty Pool.
The endless summer does sound fun.
And profitable.
Fun and profitable. Big business does it again.
Unfortunately, for those of us who aren't talking sponges, climate change isn't quite as fun. Luckily, there are many easy ways for students to conserve energy.
If chargers for cell phones, cameras, and laptops are left plugged in, they continue to draw electricity even when not connected to the device. This phantom load can be avoided by unplugging electronics and chargers after use. A more convenient option is to hook electronics up to a power bar, which can be switched off after use.
For more energy-saving tips, go to www.bchydro.com. This message brought to you by BC Hydro and CITR 101.9 FM Vancouver.
I'm going to be around my vegetables. I'm going to chow down my vegetables. I love you most of all, my favorite vegetable.
Sprouts. It's your 75-cent coffee fix in the sub. It's your source for reasonably priced, creatively named stew and vegan brownies.
It's your purveyor of bicycle-delivered local produce.
It's also a place where volunteers can realize their vision of responsible business and where like-minded students can explore UBC's food systems.
Hark! Sprouts is currently accepting applications for next year's executive board and is encouraging ambitious, creative, and disciplined students from all faculties and year levels to apply.
Come by Sprouts in the sub-basement to learn more about our projects and how to get involved.
Oh, dear.
potato. I tried to kick the ball, but my tinny flew right out. I'm red as a beet, 'cause I'm so embarrassed.
The AMS Speakeasy provides information, peer counseling, and crisis support to the UBC community. Speakeasy volunteers are carefully chosen and trained to assist students in dealing with a wide range of issues, including relationship breakups, substance abuse, sexuality, and exam stress. To access our service for information or counseling, drop in to visit our desk on the north side of the sub-concourse. All drop-ins and call-ins are strictly confidential. We also have an online email referral service. If we can't help you, we can refer you to someone who can.
You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9, broadcasting live from the Student Union Building at UBC. Thanks for being with us. We are now going to turn to local news to bring you a discussion on supportive housing in Vancouver, with reporter Carrie Baptist speaking to Dr. Michelle Patterson, clinical psychologist, adjunct professor at SFU, and co-author of a recent report on housing and support for adults in BC with severe addictions and or mental health issues. Mental health illness. Dr. Patterson is also co-investigator on the At-Home Chez Soi research demonstration project on homelessness and mental health, a project coordinated by the Mental Health Commission of Canada.
In Vancouver, housing is a hot topic, as illustrated by the recent squad in the tent city, and just there's always a lot of talk about it, especially in terms of the downtown east side. Around 70% of people who are underhoused, so homeless or in SROs, have mental health concerns. So it seems in Vancouver the real issue isn't housing as much as it's supportive housing.
Well, I think it's a combination, right? I often think of things as kind of an iceberg. And absolutely, at the tip of the iceberg, you have, you know, people who are homeless with severe addictions and mental illness and a lot of public disorder, kind of that visible behavior that you see on the street. But then at the base of the iceberg are people who are living in poverty and not able, who are just kind of one paycheck away from eviction. And so I think that there's a need for intervention at all levels of the iceberg, so to speak. So we absolutely need more affordable housing. And I think that is one of the drivers of the issue, is the lack of affordable housing in the city. But absolutely, it's a complex issue. So there are lots of multifaceted contributors to the problem. So there are absolutely there's very little in the way of support for people with mental illness. Often to get into a mental health team, you need to have a very clear diagnosis. And oftentimes there are people who don't fit into those clear categories, and our mental health teams, for the most part, are at capacity. So I think a lot of that cycling out of housing and into jails and hospitals and detox and on the street and in shelters, that's often most prevalent and visible among the population of people who have mental illness and addiction.
For people who don't know, can you talk about the difference between regular affordable housing and supportive housing, and what benefits that might have for somebody who has mental illness?
Yeah, so kind of affordable housing, also called social housing, is housing where the rent is subsidized by the government. So it is not your typical market rent. It's a lower rent. But aside from the rent decrease, that's basically the only difference from, you know, housing that, you know, your typical citizen lives in. Supportive housing has the rent subsidy as well as support on site. And that can, it comes in a number of different models. So sometimes the support is, oftentimes the support is very minimal. So it can be perhaps, you know, just one person who's on site 24/7, who's kind of more of a, plays more of a security role or a building management role. Ideally, especially for people who have very severe addictions and mental illness, you want to have more multidisciplinary support. So, you know, some nursing support, some psychiatry, some GP sessions, some workers who are able to help people integrate back into the community and develop life skills. So those are the supports that are very hard to come by that we don't see very much of here in Vancouver. And there are a number of different models. Sometimes those supports are delivered on site. Sometimes it's more of a mobile outreach team that connects with people in the community so that there's a separation between housing and support. So there's a number of different ways that it can be delivered.
And then for people with who are mental health consumers, there's been a lot of research done on the specific benefits that they receive from supportive housing.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk about that?
Sure. Yeah, no, I think the literature is fairly robust in showing that people who live in supported housing, the big improvement is in residential stability. So people are less likely to be evicted, less likely to be homeless. People are also more likely to engage in the workforce. So I think more stability in terms of housing is just a basic prerequisite for being able to engage in the workforce, engage in the community. There's some evidence, it's a little bit weaker with regards to reduction in mental health symptoms and reduction in addictions. Usually people in supported housing, their addiction, their substance use lessens. And so that's the real, I guess, philosophy of the housing first approach, is that by not requiring that somebody be sober before they enter housing, you promote this sense of choice and autonomy where an individual can kind of decide how much they can use or how much they can manage before in terms of being able to balance their other responsibilities.
Housing first is a harm reduction type of housing, mm-hmm. which brings a certain amount of controversy from people on one hand who say that it successfully fulfills the mandate of harm reduction, that it improves people's health, and then people on the other side who say that it doesn't do enough in the sense that, yes, people are being housed and that you have improvements in their general health, but that they are continuing to use and that their rate of getting clean isn't.
Mm-hmm. I think the really exciting thing about the Housing First literature is that it really shows that choice and autonomy is really critical to helping people improve their lives, gain housing stability, and integrate into the community. So the difference, Housing First is quite a radical approach in a way and is controversial. The old approach, the more traditional approach, is that people have to prove that they're ready to be housed, and they have to prove that they're ready to be housed by committing to being in treatment, whether that be treatment for substance use or treatment for mental illness. And then once they've shown to be kind of stable, then they're given housing. In the Housing First approach is that people are provided with long-term permanent housing with no conditions attached. They don't have to prove that they're ready to be housed. They don't have to say, you know what, I'm going to stop using. You know what, I'm going to commit to treatment. And so it works with the person where they're at, and it gives them more autonomy, more choice over their lives. And I think in general, you know, people do better when they feel they've got some choice rather than when they're having rules shoved down their throat. And so oftentimes when people are given the choice, they engage in treatment much more willingly, they reduce their substance use much more willingly, and really kind of meet those requirements at the end of the day. So I think it's really about being able to give people the choice and create an environment where they can create change on their own.
For sure.
With support. And the support piece is really critical. And the housing first model, when it is implemented properly, has support services available so that, you know, really the basic requirement is that the individual meets with a caseworker once a week, and that that a certain proportion of their disability check goes towards their income. So it's not a completely free ride, and it's not that there are no requirements, but there are very few barriers. So the Mental Health Commission, so it's called the At Home Project, and this is a project that's going on in 5 cities across Canada. Here in Vancouver, we are recruiting 500 homeless people. We started in October of 2009 and we'll be finishing recruitment in March of 2011. And people are, 300 of those individuals will be assigned to various different kinds of housing and support. And all of the housing follows the housing first model. So 200 of the 300 will be in apartments that are scattered throughout the city, so kind of market rental apartments that have a substantial rental subsidy with kind of mobile outreach support. And then 100 individuals will be housed in a building where everybody in the building will be part of the program, and there will be, you know, fairly intensive on-site supports. So we'll be able to really look at what kind of housing and support works for whom. The focus of the project is on people who are chronically homeless with a severe mental illness. Substance abuse is not required. But certainly, just given the population here in Vancouver, we're definitely seeing a lot of people who have substance use disorders.
Can we talk a little bit about the current mental health infrastructure in Vancouver? So,
sure.
There was a wave of deinstitutionalization, people being moved out of Riverview towards community-based care.
Mm-hmm.
How successful has this been, and what kind of role does supportive housing play?
Mm-hmm. I think in general there are really mixed opinions with regards to that. I think in general people say that it was not very successful. The deinstitutionalization kind of process really grew out of a kind of consumer rights movement, as well as evidence that showed that many people with severe mental illness can live in the community. They can live successfully in the community. However, they need support. And so many people, I think the problem was that people were moved out of institutions and the community-based services were not made available. And so there was a real kind of gap created in terms of being able to support people in the community. So it's not that people with severe mental illness can't function and live very well in the community. It's that the community-based services were not made available in order to support that population.
Right, and it seems that we're at a point where a lot of the burden of mental health care is being put onto general hospitals and the police.
Yeah,
The police have been turned into frontline mental health mm-hmm. workers, and mm-hmm. they're empowered by the Mental Health Act to put people into general hospitals, which mm-hmm. unfortunately don't have very much or any space for long term, and are very full as it is. And so people who are apprehended or sort of contacted by the police are either put into general hospitals or into jails.
Mm-hmm. And it's not, I think it's a very expensive way, it's a very ineffective and expensive way of serving people's mental health needs. So, no, we need a lot more community-based care, as well as, I think the outreach approach works really well in addition. A lot of people with severe mental health and addiction issues don't do very well with kind of appointment-based, office-based kinds of services. So having teams of individuals who can go out and meet with a person at their home, in their community, help them be able to navigate services in the community, really help them get engaged in programs and activities and build the skills that people need in order to be able to really successfully live in the community, that's a big piece that's missing. I think another big piece that's missing is addiction services. And that kind of, that's the range from detox services to, you know, a number of specialized addiction services like residential care, substitution therapies, access to psychiatry. That's a big piece. I think the other big piece that's missing is counseling. Not only do people have, you know, conditions that could benefit from medication, but there's also a lot of other issues, grief, trauma, all kinds of attachment-related issues that often go untreated. And so I think there's a real need for helping people deal with all of the kind of life issues and life history, difficult life histories that people have endured. So that's a component that is very difficult for people to obtain currently.
And that was Dr. Michelle Patterson. Our own Carrie Baptist was speaking to her about mental health and addiction issues in Vancouver. You're listening to CITR News 101, broadcasting at 101.9 FM in Vancouver and at streaming online at citr.ca. We're actually now going to take a quick break and stay with us because we're bringing you the Free Speech Radio News headlines following this quick break.
You know, Joe, you start with these riffs in your head.
We're good.
And something you want to say, and you want to spin gold, but the thing is, people don't want your sounds. They only want...
You people, you're the fucking coolest!
Just fucking use you. You know what I'm saying, Joe?
What is that? What is it? One more shot? A saloon?
Sore Throats, Clapping Hands, hosted by Robert Privet, Monday at midnight on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
And in the end, it's love. And in the end, it's love. And in the end, it's love.
And we're back to CITR 101.9 FM, News 101. It's now 5:37 and time for your weekday weather forecast. For that, we turn to weather reporter Daniel Casanova. Thanks for being with us, Daniel.
Thanks, Andrew. Well, we can expect conditions to clear up towards the end of the week. A jet stream ridge is expected to make its way towards Vancouver by Thursday, giving us a break from the recent frontal activity patterns we've been experiencing the past few days. This expected clearing will allow for increased daytime high temperatures and decreased nighttime lows due to an absence of overhead cloud layers. Here's your weekday forecast. For tonight, we will have a few showers beginning late tonight, low of 6 degrees. For Tuesday, we will have rain ending later in the day but picking up again at night. High winds for some part of Vancouver at around 50 kilometers per hour, easing up in the afternoon. High of 11 degrees and a low of 6. For Wednesday, it will be cloudy with a high of 11 and a low of 6 degrees. On Thursday, it will be sunny with a few clouds in the morning, high of 12 degrees and a low of 2. Finally, for Friday, it will be sunny as well with a high of 13 degrees and a low of 2. Currently, it is 10 degrees at YVLR. That's your weather this week, brought to you by the UBC Storm Club. For News 101, I'm Daniel Casanova.
And thank you, Daniel, for that forecast. We're now going to turn to our FSRN news headlines coming from Free Speech Radio News, and these are the headlines for Monday, March 15th.
I'm Nell Abram with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. In Bangkok today, Thailand's Prime Minister dismissed demands that he step down. Claudia Craig has more.
Addressing the people of Thailand on national television today in the face of mass protests, Prime Minister Abhisit Wejjajiwa dismissed calls by the tens of thousands of red shirts as a personality cult for ousted former PM Thaksin Shinawatra. Thaksin supporters tend to be from low-income rural areas who favour his populist politics. Supporters of the current government criticise the demonstrators with the United Front for Democracy Against Dictatorship, citing the travel expenses allegedly paid to each protester. Fears that violence may lead to a coup have increased after four explosions early this afternoon at the government's peacekeeping command. Two soldiers were injured. Organisers say they will now further cripple the capital and plan to pour blood from 100,000 followers over the government's main administrative offices tomorrow. Claudia Craig, FSRN.
Vietnamese authorities released a prominent human rights advocate from prison today. Father Nguyen Van Ly served 3 of an 8-year sentence for distributing anti-communist materials. All told, Father Ly has spent nearly 15 years in prison over more than 3 decades on various charges related to pro-democracy activities. He suffered 2 strokes during his most recent incarceration. U.S. officials say they believe he was released on medical grounds. Militants in the Niger Delta set off 2 bombs at the venue of a post-disarmament conference today. Sam Olukoya reports from Lagos.
The car bombs exploded at the government house in Warri, the second largest city in the Niger Delta. Dignitaries at the talks, including state governors and federal ministers, ran for safety as glass doors and windows were shattered. The conference was supposed to find ways of finally ending insurgency in the Niger Delta following a disarmament program. Even though some militants accepted the disarmament, many others refused. The main militant group in the region, the Movement for the Emancipation of the Niger Delta, which claimed responsibility for the car bombs, did not disarm during the program. The bombs appear to be a message from the group that the insurgency is far from over. Sam Olukoya, FSRN, Lagos.
Israel extended closures of the West Bank and within Jerusalem today. Government officials say they're attempting to quell clashes between the IDF and Palestinians. This follows Israel's announcement last week that it will build 50,000 new settlers' homes in East Jerusalem. Israel's prime minister said today that the settlements will go forward. Ghassan Banoura reports from Bethlehem.
Tension remains high in East Jerusalem as settlers' right-wing groups open a controversial Jewish synagogue. Clashes were reported early Monday when Israeli troops did not allow men under the age of 50 to enter Jerusalem's Old City and the Al-Aqsa Mosque, the third holiest site for Muslims worldwide. In Ramallah, 10 students were injured when Israeli troops used tear gas and rubber-coated steel bullets to suppress protests against the settlement construction. Also near Ramallah, Israeli forces declared the villages of Bil'in and Na'lin will be considered closed military zones every Friday for the next 6 months. The order forbids Israelis and international supporters from entering the villages on Fridays or face arrests and deportation. The 2 villages are the location of weekly protests against both the barrier wall and West Bank settlements. Ghassan Banoura, FSRN, Bethlehem.
Drug violence swept through Mexico's Pacific coast state of Guerrero this weekend, killing at least 45 people, more than 30 in the beach resort town of Acapulco. Shannon Young reports.
Most of the 45 people killed in Guerrero over the weekend died from gunfire. 5 people were beheaded. Among the dead are policemen killed in drive-by shootings, suspected members of the drug trade targeted by assassins or killed in a gun battle with soldiers, and at least 1 civilian hit by a stray bullet. While there's no official explanation for the surge in violence in Guerrero, widely circulated rumors tell of a new alliance among 3 powerful cartels to eliminate another. Weekends with double-digit death tolls are usually only seen in Ciudad Juarez. The northern border city located across from El Paso, Texas, was also the site of violence this weekend. Among the dead are 3 people connected to the U.S. consulate in Juarez. They were shot in front of their children in 2 separate attacks after leaving a child's birthday party. 2 of the children were injured. The State Department has since authorized consular employees in 6 border cities to move their families to the U.S. Shannon Young, FSRN, Mexico.
For Free Speech Radio News from WMNF Community Radio in Tampa, I'm Nell Abram.
And thank you to Free Speech Radio News for bringing us those headlines. I'd also like to remind listeners that we will be providing those headlines to you every edition of News 101, Mondays and Fridays, usually around 5:30 on both of our broadcasts. And our podcasts can also be found at citr.ca. Thank you for listening. This is News 101, broadcasting at CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. And we're now going to take a quick break, but stay with us. The last story we bring you today is in international news on the recent elections in Colombia. Stay tuned. You're listening to News 101.
CITR podcast update number one.
Work has begun on Canada's information highway. That's the state-of-the-art network that we're told will change everything from the way we do business to the way we learn. Without getting too technical, tell me how what you're working on is different from what's available to me right now.
So right now, if you want to listen to your favorite CITR program, you need to be listening to it on your radio live or streaming over the internet live. But with CITR podcasts, you'll be able to download your favorite show and listen to it whenever you want, on your computer or on your MP3 player.
I'm just thinking about that.
I know, it's pretty rad.
For more information, visit CITR.ca/podcast. Thank you for listening, and please be kind to robots.
I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now!, daily grassroots global unembedded international independent news hour. And this is CITR 101.9 FM.
The AMS Speakeasy provides information, peer counseling, and crisis support to the UBC community. Speakeasy volunteers are carefully chosen and trained to assist students in dealing with a wide range of issues, including relationship breakups, substance abuse, sexuality, and exam stress. To access our service for information or counseling, drop in to visit our desk on the north side of the sub-concourse. All drop-ins and call-ins are strictly confidential. We also have an online email referral service. If we can't help you, we can refer you to someone who can.
Welcome back. In international news, we bring you coverage of the recent elections in Colombia. Conservative parties dominated congressional elections in Colombia yesterday, taking more than 65% of seats in the Senate and a majority in the House. The winning parties are allied to Colombian President Alvaro Uribe, and some say their victory ensures the continuation of Uribe's hardline security policies. For this story, we turn to Free Speech Radio News.
Conservative parties dominated congressional elections in Colombia yesterday, taking more than 65% of seats in the Senate and a majority in the House. The winning parties are allied to Colombian President Alvaro Uribe, and some say their victory ensures the continuation of Uribe's hardline security policies. FSRN's Manuel Rueda has more from Bogota.
Elections went by peacefully in Colombia on Sunday. Late at night, after the polls closed, members of the Green Party gathered in a Bogota convention center to await the results. Olga Torres volunteered for this party during the 3 months prior to the election.
We're going through times when there is a lot of corruption in Congress, a lot of narco-politics. But the Green Party is like the environment. It will oxygenate Congress. It will renew institutions and freshen up the country. That's why we're here, because we're convinced this party can make a difference.
Green Party's new here, and it surprised political pundits by taking 5 out of 100 Senate seats. Their candidates come mostly from academia and have been successful in city governments, implementing innovative transportation programs like environmentally friendly public buses that use exclusive lanes. However, they took only a small portion of the total votes. The big winners last night were right-wing parties allied to President Alvaro Uribe, which took 65 of 100 seats in the Senate. The National Unity Party is still the largest member of the governing coalition. Outside campaign headquarters, its leader and presidential candidate Juan Manuel Santos spoke to his supporters about the victory.
Han sido unos resultados excepcionales. La votación.
We have had exceptional results. Our party got 70% more votes than in the last elections. These results are a vote of confidence in the policies of President Uribe, and they tell us that we must continue to work to improve these policies.
y por su mejoramiento.
Colombia is staging presidential elections in May, and Santos is one of seven candidates competing to succeed Uribe. Political analyst Javier Loaiza predicts right-wing parties will also attract many votes in the presidential poll.
Va a funcionar como una especie de sistema semiparlamentario. ¿Por qué?
This works almost like a parliamentary system. What these elections showed us is the strength of candidates from parties that have been in the Uribe coalition for the past 8 years, compared to the strength of opposition parties.
Durante estos casi ocho años y la oposición.
Beyond the results, election observers here are also worried about who's getting into the new Congress. Almost one-third of Colombia's Congress members are currently under investigation for links with paramilitary groups and drug traffickers, and some have been convicted. During the current campaign, election monitors revealed a list of more than 80 politicians who were allegedly receiving funds from drug traffickers and paramilitary groups to buy votes and to run their campaigns. Final results for House of Representatives races across the country are not in yet, but politics professor Jorge Iván Cuervo says that a new generation of politicians with paramilitary links could be entering Colombia's Congress.
Many congressmen who have been convicted for paramilitary politics will not be in the new Congress, but it has been documented that these people who have transferred their power and connections to another set of people, including their wives, their children, and their friends.
Most of the politicians with alleged links to drug traffickers and paramilitaries belong to pro-government parties like the National Unity Party, the Conservative Party, and the National Integration Party, or PIN. Colombia's National Election Monitoring Mission is waiting for final results before tallying how many of the new Congress members could be receiving dirty money. But regardless of these corruption problems and allegations of vote buying, analyst Javier Loaiza says that Colombia will continue to vote conservative.
In the last elections in the U.S., people were tired of Bush, so they wanted change and they chose Obama because he positioned himself as a change candidate. People in Colombia are not tired of the Uribe model yet, so they want to pick someone who is more or less the same and who continues with Uribe's policies.
Former defense minister and National Unity Party leader Juan Manuel Santos is now the top contender in the May presidential elections. But he's challenged by conservative rivals and progressive candidates who are hoping to surprise the pundits. Manuel Rueda, FSRN, Bogota, Colombia.
And to hear Manuel Rueda's first part of this series on the elections in Colombia, go to fsrn.org.
And thanks to FSRN, that's Free Speech Radio News, for that coverage. For more FSRN coverage, you can go to fsrn.org. And that's our program for March 15th, 2010. Today's newscast was brought to you entirely by volunteer efforts. If you'd like to share your comments, give us a hot news tip, or get involved with the show, contact us. Our phone number is 604-822-5334, or you can email news@citr.ca. Be sure to follow us on Twitter with the username CITR News. You can subscribe to our podcast and listen to past shows at citr.ca. Brad Pepping produced this radio program. Brad Pepping and Adam produced this radio program. For more news, join us Monday at 5 p.m. for another edition. Sorry, join us this Friday at 5 p.m. for another edition of News 101. I'm Andrew Longhurst from the entire news team here at CITR. Thanks for listening. Stay tuned for Career Fast Track up next, but we're going to leave you with two tracks from Fanshawe, a local band. The two tracks are Diana and Dark Eyes, so stay tuned right here, and then Career Fast Track coming up after those songs. You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.